This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alison Bechtel, has a new graphic memoir, but let's start with some background. She wrote and illustrated the graphic memoir Fun Home, which was adapted into a musical that won Tony Awards in 2015 for Best Musical, Best Score, and Best Book for a Musical. The story is about how Bechtel grew up in the funeral home her parents ran, which was opened by her great-great-grandfather. The F-U-N in Fun Home is short for funeral. When Bechtel came out at age 19, she learned that her father had had gay relationships throughout his marriage, and Bechtel's mother knew about it all along. Soon after Bechtel talked with her father about his secret life, he threw himself in front of a truck and was killed. At least that's how Bechtel thinks he ended up killed by that truck. Before writing graphic memoirs, Bechtel wrote and illustrated a comic strip called Dykes to Watch Out For. Her new graphic memoir, The Secret to Superhuman Strength, is about her obsession with exercise and getting stronger, running, skiing, bicycling, Pilates, karate, weightlifting, mountain climbing, yoga. The exercise obsession has been an attempt to shut up her anxious mind, unite mind and body, reach a state of transcendence, and look and feel as physically strong as possible. She's been inspired by the great literary transcendentalists, as well as by muscle men. But extreme exercise has also created problems, like many obsessions do. Alison Bechtel, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
You're so in your head, thinking all the time, drawing autobiographical comics, but you're also really into your body, into strength and endurance. Tell us about the disconnect between mind and body that you wanted to fix.
Well, this has been going on for my whole life. I feel like I just have always had a lot of energy and I've enjoyed physical activity, and it has worked out to kind of save me from my other predisposition of being extremely self-conscious and very caught up in my head. So exercise has been a way of like modifying that, you know, very cerebral thing going on.
So hoping that outer transformation would lead to inner transformation.
I guess that's the idea. Yes.
You also have an inner old Republican man inside you. Who is that man and what is he? Why is he a part of you?
I'm a feminist. I'm a lesbian. I'm a total like blue state Democrat. But I do acknowledge that I have this part of me that just wants to be left alone. I don't want to be connected to other people. Other people are like a problem. I don't really believe that, but there is this strain in me that understands that rugged individualist archetype, you know, like that you can do everything yourself and you don't need anyone's help. So I also see that is a problem. And the book for me was a way of trying to overcome that aspect of myself.
With the inner old Republican man?
Yes.
Okay. And how is exercise a way to do that?
Well, exercise for me, it is physical. It's very much about being in my body, but it's also kind of a metaphysical thing that I'm after. There's something that happens for me when I'm working out intensely, where my mind just quiets down and I feel my self, my everyday self, the self that we all identify with, the self on our driver's license, you know, that self can be very pesky and annoying. And I like it when that self quiets down. So that happens often when I exercise.
You see exercise, your obsession with exercise as being a product of your generation. What are some of the trends in exercise that you've witnessed and participated in, as well as some that you've witnessed and thought, not for me, thanks?
Well, I feel like I have been, my lifespan has sort of coincided with the whole modern phenomenon of exercise. People didn't really exercise much before 1960, which is when I was born. So I grew up watching Jack LaLanne on TV. I grew up seeing the Charles Atlas bodybuilding ads in my comic books. And when I was 6 or 7, my parents took up downhill skiing. So that was my first actual organized athletic activity. And I really loved it. That too was like just a trend that was sort of coming into the fore. Like wealthy people had skied, but starting in the middle of the century, more regular people could afford to go skiing, and that became a thing. I took up jogging in my teens in the 1970s, when that was a big craze.
You have not mentioned Jane Fonda aerobics, which was so big in, was it the 80s?
Yes, my mother totally was a Jane Fonda fanatic. But that was happening at a time when I was very immersed in studying martial arts. There were a lot of similarities between the Jane Fonda workout and aerobics and the kind of martial arts training I was doing. It's all very super aerobic.
You referred to Charles Atlas and how, you know, you wanted to be Charles Atlas when you were a kid reading comic books, but a lot of people won't remember who Charles Atlas is. So why don't you tell us?
Charles Atlas was an early bodybuilder. And he made his fame and fortune by selling his program through, I think, mainly comic books for children, maybe probably in other magazines too, but certainly it's like an archetypal childhood experience for people of my generation to have seen his ads. He's standing there in his leopard skin Speedos with his big chest and shoulders. And it's accompanied with a cartoon, this wonderful cartoon of the bully kicking sand on a little skinny guy. So the little skinny guy sends away for the Charles Atlas workout program and builds himself up until he can knock out the bully next time this happens.
Did you see yourself as the little skinny guy who wanted to get muscles?
Absolutely. Yeah. All these ads, I mean, there were other kinds of bodybuilding ads in the comic books too, and they all talked about skinny kids and skinny kids whose ribs stuck out. And I was certainly, I would look in the mirror and see my ribs sticking out, and I just feel like, oh man, I just want to be bigger.
And it was, of course, a very male image of a physically like enhanced body through exercise. And you were a girl looking at that. Did you want his body?
You know, it's funny to me. I mean, I did. I guess there was a certain amount of like gender fluidity going on. It didn't seem, there seemed to be no dissonance between being a girl and this body. I just thought, well, I'll just lift a lot of weights. And in fact, you know, when women do lift weights and as serious bodybuilders, they do kind of look like Charles Atlas. But I never went that route.
So you mentioned Jack LaLanne on TV, and he had this like really early exercise show that was geared mostly to women who were home, taking care of their home and taking care of their children. Describe your memories of the show. I remember when I was a kid, kind of turning the channels and watching him for a few minutes because it just seemed funny to me.
He was funny. I mean, he was very charming. When I look at some of the footage now, like they have clips up on YouTube, it's super condescending. Like he's just, you know, so talking down to these housewives about, you know, you gals, it's really important to you to have a thin ankle, isn't it? But he also was he just had a cheery, can-do attitude about exercise. He made it very accessible and fun. He talked about how exercise gave you energy. I feel like I learned something from him about, you know, relating to your own body. But I was also very fascinated with his physique. You know, he had this tiny little waist and these big shoulders and giant arms. And he was never showing you the kind of exercises that you would do if you wanted to get big arms. He was just showing funny little stretches and twists and things that housewives might want to do.
So you were deep into like building your muscles, but you hated gym. You hated the gym uniform. Does this again have to do with groups, like not wanting to do exercise in a group setting in school?
Yeah, I just, you know, high school was just I was just paralyzed with self-consciousness for that whole period. and gym class sort of heightened it, you know, having to play sports and know what to do on the field. And then the horrible shower we had to take. This was really traumatic for me. We had to like strip down and take showers as part of our gym class. I feel like this doesn't happen so much in schools. They've realized how barbaric that was, and kids don't really need to take showers. But it was this rite of passage that they put us through.
Did anybody make fun of your body?
No, but they didn't need to. I was, you know, completely just frozen with self-consciousness. Oh, and I tried to undress in the toilet stall so people couldn't see me, but the gym teacher put an end to that.
When you were old enough to start reading the literary Transcendentalists, who also helped inspire your quest to unite mind and body, and to reach some kind of transcendent state through, you know, physical workouts. Who were you reading? What were some of the ideas in those books that you found inspiring?
I didn't actually read any of the real transcendentalists like Emerson or Thoreau or Margaret Fuller until I was writing this book. I discovered them quite late in life. But I read Jack Kerouac's wonderful book, The Dharma Bums, when I was, well, I wasn't young then either. I was like around 30 when I read that book. And I loved the way he wrote about being outside, hiking in the mountains, and talking with his friend Gary Snyder, the poet, about Zen and about the universe. That was a really great model for me. And I felt like I wanted to try and get at something like that in my book, that way of just wondering about the world while you're out exercising in it.
You came out when you were 19 and you were in college. Did that affect your body image and how you wanted to look and how it was acceptable to look within the gay community?
Oh, that's a really good question, Terry. You know, I was very fortunate to come out into a very strong lesbian feminist subculture where I immediately was like deprogrammed of all the crazy female body image stuff I had picked up on during my teenage years, you know, all the worries about being too fat, all that craziness. Like I had suddenly a political framework for it, and I could see how nutty that was. I'm very grateful that I had that experience. You know, I started learning about how, you know, I would hear from women with disabilities about how able-bodied people are actually only temporarily able-bodied. I would hear from fat women about, you know, how fat is just like a normal human condition, and it's crazy to perseverate over trying to lose weight. I had a very really strong introduction to all these thoughts at a very young age, which I'm very grateful for.
And you were able to start dressing the way you wanted to.
Yes. Yeah, I, you know, was able to just wear the men's clothes, the androgynous outfits that I had always longed to wear as a child but was not allowed to do. I even got a pair of high tops after I came out. It was high top sneakers were always for boys, and I was never allowed to have them. Well, once I was allowed to get a pair, but only once.
After you came out to your mother, she told you about your father having had all these gay relationships throughout her marriage to him. And then you talked to your father about it. And he told you he wanted to dress in girls' clothes as a kid, but of course he wasn't allowed to do it. But he wouldn't let you dress in boys' clothes. And I just think that's so, so I don't know what. I mean, he knew what it was like, but he prevented you from doing it.
You know, I honestly think he didn't grasp the parallel. I know he was surprised when I came out. He had not expected that, which is so funny because it seems like to me I was so obviously, you know, a little lesbian. But by the same token, he was very obviously a gay man and I didn't see it. So it was just a funny way that although we were very close, we just kind of missed each other in that way.
So after you talked to your father about how you were gay and about how he was gay and had this secret life, he, not long after that, he died, and he was killed by a truck, and you're pretty confident that he threw himself in front of the truck because why?
My mother had recently asked him for a divorce, and it actually didn't, it wasn't my immediate thought that he had killed himself. It was only after I got home on the day that he died, and we got through this whole day of dealing with that, and my mother and I were sitting alone finally out on the porch at night, and she said to me that she thought it had been intentional, and immediately I agreed with her. It seemed like it made sense. It seemed like it solved his problems. And I guess too, there's a part of me that wishes it was intentional and not accidental, because for it to be accidental is just too sad and awful. But at least if it had been what he wanted, well, he got it.
A month after his funeral, which was also a month before your 20th birthday, you went to a women's music festival with your then girlfriend, Joan, who people will recognize from Fun Home if they've read the book or seen the musical. So this is a women's music festival in Michigan. Would you describe what the festival was like and why it was so important to you?
Yeah, the Michigan Women's Music Festival, this was 1980. It was a really remarkable sort of utopian experiment in the wilds of Michigan. It was a music festival that was all women. And I'd never been in a, any kind of setting where there were only women. And I was curious about what this was going to be like. And when we got there, it was just, it was mind-blowing. All women were driving the tractors. Women were building the stages and putting up the tents. Like, it was this amazing self-sufficient community all run by women. And it was just also very powerful to be in a space where there weren't any men who were looking at you, harassing you, groping you, taunting you. You didn't even realize how omnipresent all that stuff was and what a toll it took on you until you had this amazing glimpse of freedom from it in this women's music festival space.
But you don't usually like being in groups, so this was different?
I would attend this festival for many years, and eventually I did get kind of worn down by the group aspect. But that the first time I was there was really just magical and transformative. And, an extension of these lessons I had been learning from feminism about just being embodied, about the fact that the mind and the body are not separate, that they're one thing, that nature is not separate from us, that we're all part of an ecosystem. That all felt like part and parcel of this feminist universe.
My guest is Alison Bechdel. Her new graphic memoir is called The Secret to Superhuman Strength. We'll talk more after a break, but first, here's a song from the Tony Award-winning musical adaptation of Bechdel's graphic memoir, Fun Home. The song is about coming out in college and her first girlfriend, Joan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
A few years ago, a website popped up in Stockton, California, and conspiracy theories started ramping way up.
And it's being funded by conservative movement underneath the table.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, people really believe this.
What happens when the local news outlet isn't fact-checking conspiracy theories? Maybe encouraging them. Listen now from NPR's Invisibilia podcast.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alison Bechdel. Her graphic memoir, Fun Home, was adapted into a Tony Award-winning musical. Her new graphic memoir, The Secret to Superhuman Strength, is about her obsession with exercise, running, bicycling, skiing, karate, yoga, mountain climbing, skiing. Bechdel is a self-satirist in examining the psychological and physical reasons behind these obsessions and how it's affected her life for better or worse. You write about relationships in your new book, and the woman who is now your spouse was in a relationship with somebody else when you started seeing her. But the idea was it was supposed to be a polyamorous lesbian relationship. I mean, she said to you, why don't you write about polyamorous lesbian relationships? Because her girlfriend had multiple girlfriends. I don't know if Holly herself did. Holly is the woman who's now your wife. So how did you feel about that when you were seeing her? And was she seeing other people too? She was in a relationship with somebody for sure, but...
Holly was seeing one other person, was seeing Gwen. And I found this very interesting. I mean, at that point in my life, I was in my late 40s, and I'd been through a series of, you know, monogamous relationships that had all ended. And I thought, well, maybe there's something to this polyamory. Maybe I should just give that a try. It wasn't that I wanted to have multiple relationships. What I wanted was the ability to openly acknowledge that my primary commitment was to my work. I feel like that had kind of been my downfall in these other relationships, just like my obsessiveness with my work life and how I just always would prioritize that over everything. So polyamory seemed like a way where that I could both have a girlfriend and my work.
How did that work out?
Not very well. I mean, polyamory was very difficult. I thought I would be like fine when Holly went off with her other partner, that I'd get to focus on my work. But in fact, I was quite jealous and preoccupied. I just, to really have a healthy polyamorous life, you just have to talk a lot. You have to communicate a lot. And this is not my forte in life. I didn't like having to spend so much time processing. The whole point for me was to not have to do that, you know?
Did you ask yourself if your inability to like overcome jealousy was a flaw in yourself or a flaw in polyamorous relationships?
I felt like it was a flaw in myself that I was very interested in pursuing. And it was interesting to a point, you know, philosophically, it's interesting to think about, like, why do we have to have these exclusive relationships? Why can't you just have what you have with people? Why do they have to, you know, why does one have to negate another? So I struggled with that for a while. The story takes a quite tragic turn because Gwen died, you know, in the middle of all this.
This is Holly's other partner.
Yes, yes. She was an avid paraglider and died in an accident. So that was just, you know, kind of stopped us in our tracks. And
yeah, and you'd come to really like her because the three of you were hanging out together a lot.
Yeah, she was a really delightful person. And yeah, I was becoming friends with her too.
So after Gwen's tragic death, and you and Holly remained a couple, did you both decide to be monogamous after that? Is that okay to ask?
Yeah, that's fine to ask. We did not make any kind of sudden decision like that. It just sort of gradually crept up on us over the years. In fact, I feel like Holly continued to identify as polyamorous, even though she wasn't actively having other relationships. And I feel like that identification has stopped recently, that she's finally decided that she's not actually polyamorous anymore.
So you're married now. You got married after the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage and marriage equality. How do you like marriage? Has it changed the relationship at all?
Honestly, no. I mean, I'm an old, you know, old school lesbian feminist. I don't really believe in marriage. I wanted to get married because it felt revolutionary. You know, it felt like I was subverting the idea of marriage, not like I was capitulating to it, although I see now that that was, in fact, you know, we do get subsumed by these institutions. But I don't feel like it's really changed my relationship. I mean, I've always felt essentially married to my partners, whether I was married or not.
When you were in your 40s, I think, you started a project to document the disintegration of your body. What were you feeling that led you to that project, and what exactly was the project?
When I turned 40, I hit this point where I realized I was actually not immortal. I know people joke about turning 40, but I really felt it very deeply, like, oh my God, this is the midway point of my life if I'm lucky. And that awareness just changed things. You know, I realized my time was limited. I needed to really, if I was going to do something in this life, I better get doing it. You know, I always have a tendency to try really hard to make things happen. So I decided I was going to make a project of facing my mortality. I was going to start seeing a meditation teacher and try and learn how to get rid of my ego. Another thing that I did at this point in my life was I started making an annual video, a video diary entry, where I talk about my year and how things went and what I'm thinking. But also I would take all my clothes off and videotape my body. And the idea was, I'm going to monitor my aging process just to see what this is like.
And are you still doing it?
I am, yeah.
So what have you been seeing? What kind of changes have you seen in the past approximately 20 years?
I haven't really done this methodically, so it's hard to just, you know, juxtapose the images. Or actually, I probably could if I'd sit down and spend some time on it. I see myself getting, you know, I'm getting an old lady body. I'm getting one of those bodies like the older women at the Y who I see who are, you know, kind of twisted and distorted and bulging in strange places. And I can see that slowly starting to happen with my body. Like there's, you know, even though I'm stretching and running and doing all this stuff, you can't stop the process of gravity and age. You just start sort of crumpling in on yourself.
You know what I like about the idea of your project documenting the changes in your body as you get older is I think it would be wonderful to reach a place where I or we could look at our bodies as we get older and go, well, that's interesting, as opposed to, oh, no, that's horrible.
You know? Exactly.
Because there's this whole thing about how an aging body is like, it's really horrible. You know, when I was younger and visiting my parents, their older friends would always say to me, don't get old. And I thought, like, what kind of advice is that? Like, should we be dying instead of getting old? Like, what are you saying exactly? But anyways, instead of, like, being in denial or having to, like, try everything we possibly can to prevent a process that's kind of natural, to reach a point where you could say, well, that's interesting. My body's changing with age. Is that something you're striving for?
Yes, it is. And I'm a little dismayed at my own resistance. I mean, we don't like aging, not because it's not attractive, but because it means we're dying. You know, that's the real reason we don't like it. So that's the root of it. That's the association. And I would love to be able to let go of that and just see the kind of amazing process that we undergo.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alison Bechdel. Her new graphic memoir is called The Secret to Superhuman Strength. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Whether you're looking to put your money to work in the short term, long term, or somewhere in between, E-Trade's got you covered. E-Trade can help you with your finances, from saving for a first home to investing for retirement. And they're backed by a team of financial professionals to give you support. To get started today, visit etrade.com/NPR for more information. E-Trade Securities, LLC, member SIPC.
Let's get back to my interview with Alison Bechdel. Her new graphic memoir, The Secret to Superhuman Strength, is about her obsession with exercise and all the psychological and physical reasons that have fed that obsession. She also wrote the graphic memoir Fun Home that was adapted into the Tony Award-winning musical. fun home. How have you drawn yourself differently as you've gotten older? Because you started, you know, how long have you been drawing yourself in your comics?
I first drew myself in an autobiographical comic in my 20s or late 20s, early 30s. So, yeah, I've had to, you know, get some kind of graphic handle on how I'm aging. And in this book, it runs in chronological order. It begins with my birth and comes right up to the present day. So if you flip through the book, I'm getting older on every page. You know, I draw myself in a sort of simplified manner. And sometimes I feel like I cultivate my personal appearance so that I look more like my drawings. Like I have kind of a cartoonish haircut that's easy to draw, and I wear these, you know, glasses. So it's very easy to draw myself, like, 'cause I already look like a drawing.
During the course of your book, like in the book itself, your mother dies of cancer. And it's during the period, I guess around 2014 when, or 2012 when Fun Home was first published?
There was a very funny timeline surrounding her illness and death. I found out she had cancer on the day I got home from my book tour for Fun Home in 2006. I had been in touch with her during this whole tour, you know, checking in. I knew she was having a polyp removed from her colon, but she didn't tell me until I'd actually gotten home from the book tour that it had been cancerous. She was trying to, like, she didn't want me to worry while I was out, you know, doing my book tour. And then she was, you know, fighting cancer. And this was interesting because I was starting to work on a second memoir, which was about her. And that was really, it was somehow something I felt I had to do. I didn't like that I was doing it. I felt like I'd already intruded enough on my mother's life, but somehow I was compelled to keep writing about, you know, this family drama. And it turned into a memoir about her. And I was writing it all the while that she was sick and going through chemo. And, you know, she was a very valiant cancer patient. She would hate to hear me use that word. She hated all those cancer narratives, you know, of surviving and thriving. And in fact, she was quite private. She didn't want people to know she was sick. Her possible death was kind of looming over this whole book as I wrote about her. I didn't know if she was even going to live to see the book. But she did, which I'm very grateful for. And that book came out in 2012. And at the same time, Fun Home had been getting turned into a musical, but it hadn't actually opened yet. And in fact, my mother died like about 5 months before Fun Home opened at the Public Theater off Broadway.
It must have been surreal to see your life and your parents' lives enacted in a musical on stage. I mean, you'd already taken that story and you know, drawn and written it, but now there were other people embodying it, and you could watch from the audience. What did that feel like?
It was amazing. You know, it's interesting talking to you now. I'm realizing how very closely that experience of seeing the play was bound up with my mother's death. And it was like both my parents had been brought back to life in this wonderful way, expressly for me in this, you know, stage show. It was magical. I loved the adaptation. I thought it was really well done, and that it really captured, you know, the essence of my book, although it was its own separate you know, aesthetic creation. And for me too, my parents were, well, my mother was an actress. Like, she acted in summer stock all the time I was growing up. And my parents had actually met in a play in college. So there was some kind of really cool, you know, full circle thing happening for me to see my parents being turned into these characters in a play.
So I want to ask you about something you said in The New Yorker. And you said that the aesthetic of gender neutrality appeals to you now, and that you're always striving to be a generic person. I'm wondering if you identify as she. So many people now are identifying as, you know, as non-binary, and using the word they instead of she or he to identify themselves. Is that something that you felt like you needed to think about?
I identify as female, as a woman, as a she, but with a sort of my own little flourish of always feeling a certain amount of dissonance with that. You know, I cultivate a somewhat masculine appearance. That's just how I feel most comfortable. And it, you know, it often gets me double takes in the locker room or in the ladies' room. But those double takes are just part of how I see myself. Like, that's who I am. If I didn't get those, I would feel like something strange was going on. I might, if I were younger, identify as non-binary. And there's probably, I mean, certainly there's some gender fluidity going on for me. But I feel like I'm too old to really, you know, I've like figured it out. I'm just my own weird kind of woman. Part of my life has been like expanding that definition and those possibilities. So, yeah, I'm going to enjoy that.
Alison Bechdel, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks very much, Terry. It was fun talking with you.
Alison Bechdel's new memoir is called The Secret to Superhuman Strength. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews one of the best films he's seen so far this year. It's called The Disciple. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Audible. Beginner's Mind is a one-of-a-kind, audio-only memoir from Grammy-winning cellist Yo-Yo Ma that merges the story of his life with musical interludes. Ma encourages others to embrace their creative purpose in building a better world. Audible is proud to offer Yo-Yo Ma's Beginner's Mind absolutely free to everyone beginning April 8th in the U.S. Visit audible.com/beginnersmind to download and start listening.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Womply. Womply is committed to helping self-employed workers and small businesses get their PPP loan. They've helped over 100,000 small businesses. Even if you're a freelancer or gig worker, you may qualify. Womply makes the process easy. Start your application at womply.com/NPR, and they'll route it to an approved lender. Apply for free today at womply.com/NPR and see if you qualify.
Explore the many ways artificial intelligence affects your everyday life and your future, for better and for worse. Listen to AI Nation from WHYY and Princeton University. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Our film critic Justin Chang says the captivating new drama, The Disciple, is one of the best movies he's seen this year. The film won the Best Screenplay Prize at last year's Venice International Film Festival. It tells the story of a young man from Mumbai who aspires to be a great classical Indian singer. Here's Justin's review.
Before I saw The Disciple, I knew nothing about Hindustani or Northern Indian classical music. By the end of the movie, I knew a little bit more, though I'd still be hard-pressed to follow the different intonations that singers bring to their performances, or to explain how a raga works. That's the musical framework that allows performers to improvise. Fortunately, no expertise is needed to appreciate The Disciple, which is both a welcome introduction to a kind of music we rarely hear on screen, and a richly layered story of a young man's artistic struggle. His name is Sharad, and he's played with great depth and emotional subtlety by Aditya Modak. It's 2006, and the 24-year-old Sharad lives in Mumbai with his grandmother, working occasionally, but spending most of his time studying his chosen art form. Hindustani classical music doesn't just require impeccable technique and brilliant improvisation. It's an all-consuming discipline, demanding a level of spiritual purity that singers can spend a lifetime trying to achieve. We learn some of this from the lectures that Sharad listens to as he rides his motorbike at night around Mumbai, in scenes that capture a calmer side of this famously bustling city. We also spend a lot of time watching and listening to him practice. The writer-director Chaitanya Tamhani immerses us in this music, letting us get used to its distinct sounds and rhythms. During this practice session, Sharad sits cross-legged on the floor and takes turns singing with his longtime teacher and guru, played by Arun Dravid. His is the first voice you hear. Sharad is completely devoted to his craft, but he's an erratic performer at best. His uninspired singing gets him ejected early from a young artist's competition, and his guru doesn't hesitate to criticize him during rehearsals, and even during a public performance. The disciple throws cold water on the notion, much beloved by so many inspirational movies, that hard work and a little luck are all it takes. It's an unsparing portrait of artistic frustration. About halfway through, the movie leaps ahead to roughly the present day and becomes an almost satirical depiction of the Indian music scene. Sharad is older and a lot more cynical, working as a schoolteacher and trying to keep his performing career afloat. He watches with both contempt and envy as a younger singer becomes an overnight sensation on an American Idol-style reality TV show. And in perhaps the movie's most emotionally lacerating scene, he has an ill-advised sit-down with a veteran music critic who witheringly dismisses Sharad's heroes, including his beloved guru. We critics, of course, make convenient movie villains. But what sets The Disciple apart is how fairly it treats all its characters, and how scrupulously it refuses to take sides. Tamhani sympathizes with Sharad through all his disappointments, and he clearly shares his belief that his art is worth pursuing and preserving. But he's also too honest a filmmaker to indulge Sharad's self-pity. Even the director's exquisite visual approach, aided here by the Polish cinematographer Michal Sobocinski, winds up subtly undermining Sharad and putting his struggles in perspective. As in Tamhani's excellent 2014 legal drama, Court, nearly every scene consists of a single uninterrupted take, framed at a careful remove from the characters. We're drawn into the cramped little rooms where Sharad practices and the large, crowded music halls where he performs. This is Aditya Modak's screen debut, and the lack of close-ups makes his performance all the more impressive. Even at a distance, and with very few words, he conveys Sharad's bitterness and disillusionment as his life refuses to go as planned. While The Disciple harks back to classic Indian films like Satyajit Ray's The Music Room, it also carries stylistic echoes of Alfonso Cuarón's similarly meditative and gorgeously photographed movie, Roma. That's no accident. Tamhani, who's 34, was mentored by Cuarón and worked on the set of Roma. Cuarón in turn provided guidance on The Disciple and is credited as an executive producer. There's something poignant about that, given how much the story focuses on the student-teacher relationship and the way artistic traditions are passed down. The Disciple may tell a story about failure, but it's a triumphant achievement from a gifted film artist.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed The Disciple, which is now streaming on Netflix. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about how a promised land to generations of Black families became a community of lost lives. My guest will be Linda Villarosa, whose latest article in the New York Times Magazine is titled Black Lives Are Shorter in Chicago, My Family History Shows Why. She covers the intersection of health and medicine and social justice. I hope you'll join us. We were very sad to learn that music critic Ed Ward died Monday. For many years, he contributed pieces to our show about the history of rock and roll. We're in the process of preparing a remembrance that we'll broadcast tomorrow. We'll close with a song by a group that Ed Ward loved, the Five Royales. I'm Terry Gross.
This is dedicated to the one I love.